It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is Vampire Weekend playing their song Oxford Comma. It has lyrics, but we can't actually play them for you because they begin, "Who gives a bleep about an Oxford comma?" Well, I'll tell you, Vampire Weekend, Ellen Jovan gives a bleep about an Oxford comma. It's the subject of the first chapter in her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Jovan is a writer and writing teacher. She works with lawyers and other business types to improve their written communication. Since 2018, she's also been the proprietor of the Grammar Table, a project in which she sets up in a public place and engages with everyday people on subjects ranging from punctuation to prepositions. She started near her home in Manhattan and eventually took the project on the road with her husband and business partner, eventually setting up a grammar table in 47 states before the pandemic hit. Now she's turned those encounters into the book, which again is called Rebel with a Clause. There's also a documentary coming out. Ellen Jovan, welcome to the 21st show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm happy to be able to talk about grammar with you today.
Well, all right. I want to begin with a question from Vampire Weekend. Who does give a hoot about an Oxford comma?
Somehow it has a little less zing with that word replacement. I was really delighted to hear that when I was waiting for us to start. Very good music, grammar music taste there. I actually don't give that much of a hoot about it, but Americans do, because that is the most common question I get. What do I think about the Oxford comma?
So maybe we should explain what the Oxford comma is, or the serial comma is, for maybe some of our listeners who haven't thought that deeply about grammar since high school.
Okay. It is the comma before the and at the end of a list, sometimes before an or at the end of the list, but people seem much more obsessed with the comma before the and because it just shows up more perhaps. So do you include it? Do you not? And as with other areas of debate and contention and grammar, it often happens because there's gray area. So it's not an absolute answer. And then that's annoying to people because they want someone to lay down the law and say, it is this way or it isn't. But guess what? You get a choice. Isn't that great? It's writing freedom. Well, unless you have to follow Associated Press
exactly,
style, and then mostly yes. You'll take it out. Yes.
So I was an Oxford comma user, and then I went to work in newspapers for 7 years, and that definitely got beaten out of me, along with many other particularities of the AP style book.
But now, are you attached to that new mode or not?
No, I mean, it's my default because I've written, I mean, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of stories in that mode. So it's just kind of what I default to. But definitely there are occasions, you point some out in the book, where it just makes sense to have that comment. It helps
avoid
confusion. Lee and Perrin, right? If I'm referring to a Worcestershire sauce or something like that, then maybe I want to, you know, make sure people understand. Why is it that people get so excited about this issue? I mean, I listened in preparation for our conversation, I listened to another interview in which you said the first draft after this chapter was well north of 100 pages. What's so worked up about this?
It was. Because there were so many stories about it. So even though the grammar issue isn't that, it's not very significant to me, the way people react to it is hilarious. And so I had so many funny encounters, you know, with mock rage. There's a guy who, you know, made like a Hulk-like sound and about it and on the beach of California, and you know, people who like it often care a lot more about including it than people who, you know, than the people who don't use it are often sort of are a little bit more indifferent. But I think part of it's because it has a name, so you can refer to it easily. Like, how do you refer to the comma between two independent clauses before a coordinated conjunction? There's nothing snappy there, so you can't just refer to that, but you can point to this guy, this comma, and say, hey, that comma, you get over here. You know, it's like you can have an easy conversation about it. And I also
not just like a name, details. Right? I'm sorry to interrupt, but not just a name, but I thought of this. I wondered if it's a question of branding, right? Because we know that there's this American tendency to think British people are smart. It's called the Oxford comma. If it was called the Fresno comma or the Scranton comma, would it carry the same weight?
Maybe not, but that sounds like so much fun. Each state could have their own version. They could decide what town they want to name it after. What should you do in your state?
The Caro comma, it's got to be. spelled like Cairo, the city in Egypt, pronounced Cairo, as many.
Well, now see, that could get some press too. I can imagine a whole flurry of excitement about the comma, the pronunciation. So I think this is good marketing. You should be a punctuation marketer.
I didn't know that was a thing. But, when I get canceled from the radio, I'll keep that in mind. So what inspired the grammar table?
I happen to like grammar a whole lot, and I've worked with words my entire professional life, either teaching grammar or writing about grammar. I've written about grammar. I've studied 25 plus languages, and as I'm talking to you, I'm sitting in front of a bookshelf with rows and rows of grammar books alphabetized from Albanian to Zulu. I just think it's fascinating, this thing that we all use in our lives. But you know how the internet happened and then people were online a lot? Well, that happened to me too, and it made me grumpy. So I said, I'm sick of chatting about language online. I'm going to go out in the real world and talk to people. So I got a table, made a sign, and I thought of it in the summer. I waited until it got a little less hot. It's really kind of gross to do the grammar table when it's 95 degrees. So, and then I went out one day and I just started talking to people, and it snowballed from there.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, we are speaking with Ellen Joven, the author of Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. As we just heard, she set up a grammar table first in her home city of New York and then took it nationwide, visiting 47 states, everywhere but I think Alaska, Hawaii, and Connecticut in her quest to bring grammar to the masses and talk to all different kinds of people about this. We want to hear from you. Do you have strong opinions about things such as the semicolon? Perhaps you have a strong opinion about using such as instead of like, as I just did in that sentence. 800-222-9455. Questions, hot takes, we want to hear from our language nerds. 800-222-9455. Or tweet us at 21st Show. So what is there a grammar type? What kind of people did you talk to? Or maybe it should be a plural, grammar types.
Grammar types come in all shapes and sizes and ages and demographics. Sometimes people come up to me because they feel their grammar is terrible, you know, and they have anxiety about it and they want to discuss it. So it's sort of like a therapy session. Sometimes people want to complain about what everyone else does. Sometimes people have very sophisticated questions that come up in their professional lives that they want to discuss and resolve. So I get kids too. I mean, kids come up and talk to me. So that's a lot of fun, actually. I would like more kid visitors.
So I think there's a stereotype of the grammar prude or prescriptivist, maybe. You write about this experience in, is it pronounced Verdi Square?
Verdi Square.
Mm-hmm. Verdi Square, yeah. This little tiny little park in New York. A man quizzes you on restrictive versus non-restrictive appositives. Talk about that encounter.
Oh yeah, I do. I get people sometimes who want to quiz me, and I do have some sympathy with that need, because if I saw some random person sitting on the street, I wouldn't necessarily automatically trust them. That I was raised not to trust strangers on the street, so that's continued into my adult life. So sometimes people want to know, they want to make sure that I'm eligible to be talking about this. I have to say it's almost always men over a certain age who do
shocking,
that.
Shocking.
That's just how it has worked out. Not exclusively, but I'm just saying it's the general trend. I actually love it. If people come up to me and just start talking about restrictive and non-restrictive appositives. So that's the thing. Like if I say my neighbor, John Smith, is loud at night, something like that. John Smith is an appositive. You did start out with a positive one, right? This isn't non-restrictive and non-restrictive clauses. It's restrictive and non-restrictive appositives. So John Smith, sorry, I'm talking to myself. This happens too a lot. So John Smith is the appositive for my neighbor. He's kind of a noun renaming of the same entity. And there's a lot of discussion about whether you put commas around them or not. So people get all confused. They often get it totally backwards. So this guy, in general, since I have many, 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 many neighbors in New York, I'm going to do my neighbor, John Smith, with no commas. That's a restrictive appositive. If I lived in the middle of, the countryside, and I had one neighbor, and I were talking about him a lot. I might do my neighbor, comma, John Smith, because there's only one. That's a non-restrictive, a positive, and those use commas. See, isn't this fun? This is what you get to talk about at the grammar table.
Well, I got to say, I am a person, I think, you know, from years in the news writing business, I've been doing this for 17 years now in newspapers and radio. I feel like I have a pretty good intuitive grasp of grammar, but honestly, I could name a preposition and a noun and a verb, but even though I went to Catholic school, I could not really diagram a sentence. I couldn't have, you know, with a gun to my head, I couldn't have told you about restrictive versus non-restrictive appositives using that language, though I very much understand, you know, the concepts you're talking about. Do you get this sort of the autodidactic grammar nerd out there who versus the person who wants to flex their ability to use these esoteric terms for the way we construct our language?
Yeah, I get a lot more of people who really are just more celebratory about language. It's a small percentage really who want to, I don't know, peeve. I mean, people use that. I think it's such a horrible sounding word, but people have verbed it. So they're grammar peevers who want to peeve about usage and grammar. And often that the complaints are grounded in an incomplete picture of language, because there are lots of English dialects flourishing, coexisting in this world. And sometimes if you live primarily in one portion of the country, you can get the impression that there's a narrower band of acceptable usage than there is if you really deal more internationally with English speakers, or, you know, even nationally, you see variety in what is acceptable. I'm a Californian, so I do some Californian things. And sometimes I get on people's nerves. I've lost my train of thought. Did I leave out an important part?
No. That's great. You've actually gifted us a nice transition into verbing of nouns, right? The verbization of nouns, I've said. This is something that, you know, I feel like it's increasingly common talk about that. I mean, this is the sort of thing where it drives some people its nails on a chalkboard. I must admit, when gifting became a big thing, it seems like just a few years ago, everybody was, we're going to start gifting things instead of, I don't know, giving them. But you talk about that tension between those of, you know, people who want to say, well, look, there's a right word and a wrong word versus like language changes. Let's roll with it.
Yeah. If people want, you know, if people are looking for a kind of grammar and usage dominatrix, I'm not going to be that person. So there are people more like that will whip, you know, they'll whip you into shape. See, I just used that for a person, and I paused and kind of altered it just, and I did that not because I feel I have to, because that is used for both people and things, contrary to what people imagine. I usually change it to a who in most writing, but that's an example of the kind of thing. Sometimes I'm just doing evasion of grief. Like, I might not really believe that something has to be exactly the way I do it, but for example, I don't think I might say I went backwards, and then someone else will cross off my S and make it backward. I don't really care about that. I don't think it matters. They're both roaming around. Who cares? That doesn't matter. So I'm not going to be that person. But it's also useful when you're working, you know, I work with people who are in a professional environment. So what's the best thing to do? What if you want to follow AP style? If you're a reporter, what should you do? I mean, there, a lot of people don't want to sit there and muse over the 5-century history of a word. They just want you to tell them what to do so that they can get on with their lives and have fun. But for the people who want to go on forever about like tiny little details, I'm there for them.
Yeah. No, I like that you say you sometimes just head off criticism. That was definitely me with such as and like, because I would just say, oh, it's like this instead of, you know, referring to a list instead of such.
Right. Exactly.
Let's go to the phones. Barb is calling on line 4 from Springfield. Barb, thank you for calling in about the Oxford comma.
Yeah, I'm an Oxford comma user, but I thought it was really interesting. I'm a CPA and I was at a tax school, and there was a court case decided against the intent of the law, because in the law, the way it was written, they did not use an Oxford comma, and it changed the interpretation of the law. So I thought that was a practical application of, you know, of that.
That's great, Barb. Thank you so much. And Ellen, I know in your day job, if you will, your companies in Texas, you work with a lot of lawyers in teaching clear communication.
Yes, I work a lot. I interact a lot with lawyers. Lawyers typically don't want that kind of help from me.
I work a lot with just a novelist who went to law school instead, right?
You know, actually, it's a technical thing. I don't do CLE credits, which so when attorneys get when they do professional development, they want CLE credits. I think that's continuing legal education.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't do it, you're just not in that market. So I work with law firms, but less with lawyers themselves.
Oh,
but lawyers and I talk a lot at the grammar table. There is a lot of discussion at the grammar table with lawyers.
But I mean, I guess that's where the Oxford comma, as Barb said, and thank you for the call, Barb, you know, could really sort of have some legal implications. All right, we need to take a break. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation with Ellen Jovin. More to come on the 21st show. Stay with us.
Everybody shut up.
All right, it's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Ellen Jovin, author of Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. And Ellen, shouldn't that song from Grease be, you sort of alluded to this before the break, You're the One Whom I Want?
First of all, I have to say, this is the best grammar soundtrack I've ever had on anything I've done. So I'm excited. I am rocking out here. Yeah, that would be really not the sexiest version, right? That's the kind of example where you see that for people a lot with things like one or those. It's very common. So your choices are, you're the one that I want, you're the one whom I want, you're the one who I want, and you're the one I want. And I would say that they chose right.
Yeah, they did. All right, let's remind listeners you can join us at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or tweet us at 21st Show. EJ tweeted, a grammar pet peeve, using the word importantly incorrectly. A correct example, I own a house, Bob said importantly. Well, I own three houses, Bill said, more importantly. That is, I don't know if that's one of the big ones you've heard from, but you did hear a lot, Ellen, about this two spaces after a period.
And I mentioned earlier,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that more, that use of important, and importantly is actually not, or no, importantly, and then more importantly, that's not the version I usually hear. People want to know whether to say more important or more importantly, we will finish by the deadline. And that one I've ultimately decided you can go either way. I do more important for that one though. But anyway, not to get distracted from the very exciting question of spaces after periods.
Well, Yeah, this is something we asked our listeners about in our text messaging group. We just solicited general questions. I included a few prompts. One is this idea of two spaces after a period. As I mentioned, coming from the school of the Church of the Associated Press style book, I'm firmly one space. But we did hear a lot of listeners. Nancy in Urbana says, she said via text, two spaces after a period via computer. Also said, thanks for focusing on a non-controversial topic. Well, maybe it's controversial to some. And indeed, Nancy, let's get into it. Sarah from Urbana says, I prefer to put two spaces after a period, but I've evolved on this. I now consider it medium by medium. And she goes on to say, texting or typing a work email, one space. Personal emails, letters, short story, returns to her preferred use of two spaces. Emily in Champagne, two spaces, and my autocorrect wants me to use just one. Annoying. And then an anonymous texter said, only one space after a period, two spaces gives away your age, dash, LOL. Actually, hyphen LOL, we can get into that. But Ellen, talk to us. Space after a period, Manhattan apartment or a Long Island estate?
Wait, first, Brian, did you never learn two spaces or did you in Catholic school?
No, I definitely learned it.
But then in your professional...
I can almost remember the moment as my editor, the late Dana Heipel, edited my first story and sort of, I was an intern at the time and he sort of looked over at me and I think sized up how much work he was going to have to do with me because I had two spaces after every period in the first story I submitted, so...
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So I grew up as a two-spacer. I had eighth grade typing class, one of the great joys of my life. So exciting to feel like such a grown-up with the typewriter. And of course, it was two spaces. That was 1979. What else would I have learned? In the mid-90s, I did my first freelance writing. And it was that moment that an editor, you know, it became clear to me that the styles had changed. So I switched to one space for all of the articles that I submitted, but I liked the description from your listener about the evolution. You know, she does it in email. It kind of crept through all the document types, but it wasn't an instant thing. It was like the tide coming in and sort of drifting over the various forms that I use. And I've been a complete one spacer for many years now. It's what I would recommend people consider. It's not a big deal if you don't. And I find especially the legal sector holds on to that extra space, is holding on longer. And but you know, we can all get along as long as you don't add two spaces to any of my documents.
Absolutely not. We got a more serious question, too, via our text message. Brandy in Champaign County said, I want to hear about English grammar and its relation to African-American vernacular English. Dive into language fluidity and dialectical flexibility and acceptability. Language should be used for good, for inclusive communication, rather than as a rigid and unyielding means of exclusion. Ellen, do you have a response to that?
Yeah, absolutely. African-American writing is an interest of mine. When I got my undergraduate degree in German studies, and then I went to UCLA after that to study comparative literature, I originally went thinking, okay, German, French, Spanish, I'm going to do that. But increasingly, I became interested in American literature and African-American literature in particular. And I loved the language variety, the artistic beauty of things that I hadn't necessarily read earlier in school, although I think I had for a high school curriculum at the time I went to high school, I think mine was pretty inclusive and diverse and varied. On top of which, if you study different languages, you just read a broader scope of types of things. So I'm not an expert in it, but I absolutely accept that there are different dialects and features of different demographic groups all over the world for English, and I'm always interested in hearing about them and celebrating them. I think, you know, we all have to have a kind of fluency with our various dialects. You know, what do we do at a barbecue with our friends versus what do we do at work? So there's, you know, you see people easing in and out of different styles, but also in general, the trend from my point of view, as someone who was born in the 1960s, is that people increasingly are trained in school to understand that there's variety, and that makes them more accepting. And I think it also allows for a greater appreciation of artistic diversity and beauty. You know, we don't want to be pedants. I always say literature first and grammar second, which is why no one invites me to parties.
No, I mean, it's great. Like, isn't it Cormac McCarthy who never uses punctuation or quotation marks in his writing? I mean, it can be to great effect. And I think we have a caller on the line. Margaret from Springfield is on line four, who might be in dialogue with one of our texters. Wes in Rock Island says, I guess I'd really like to get rid of as much punctuation as possible. Margaret, I understand you're a junior high English teacher. What's your perspective on this?
Oh, yes. I think, like the rules in math for proceeding in operations, I think grammar should be taught. Yes, the uses are evolving, but I do think kids need to know punctuation. I think they still need to know spelling. I teach that you're writing for an audience. You're writing for a reader. Without punctuation, can't read it, can't understand it. They do write these days like they text, and they do have a lot of learning. They need to slow down. It really is a matter of slowing down and reading your writing, focusing, concentrating, but they struggle with it. They struggle with it, but I think it should be taught.
Interesting. All right. Thank you for that. Ellen, do you have a response to...
I agree with everything Margo... Yes, I agree with everything Margo just said. I had a very... people tend to favor the way they were taught. So I try to be really careful about that. But I loved the repetition, the drilling, the rigor of the way I was taught throughout school. I think it's important to have a solid... Like for maximum confidence and... I don't know, for me, it feels like for the kind of skill that I needed as a writer, I think teaching a rigorous set of reasonable rules, like not made up rules, like don't teach kids they can't begin sentences with because that's just not true. And that's unfortunate that so many children believe it or believe they were taught it or were taught it. But teach them rigor, have them reading alongside that so that they can see writers who experiment and test limits of language and use it in new ways. And I think those twin things are important so that you go out in the world and you have, I loved also that Margo said, you're writing for a reader. When people say to me, it's a matter, you understood what I said. And I'm thinking, yeah, but I never want to read anything you wrote again. That's not good writing hospitality. You want to be like, you're a host to your reader. So when your guest shows up for dinner at your house, you don't toss a, you know, put a mop in their hands and make them clean up the mess you made in the kitchen. You make them comfortable. You make their life easy. So good writing is good etiquette from my point of view.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, having transitioned from newspapers to radio, it really does. You sort of learn the importance of writing for people to hear and understand you. Because if you ever tried to read, like, pick the lead story in today's New York Times and try to read it out loud, and you understand that there's a whole different skill set of, you know, writing for the radio and the ear and writing to be just understood as people speak with you. It's really transformational. We just have a few minutes left. I wonder, you talked earlier about, you know, older men who come up to you and want to quiz you. What is the worst opinion you've ever heard on grammar at the grammar table?
You know, I shut people down pretty quick in a polite way, in a diplomatic way. But I'm so not interested in talking about how everything's going to hell and, you know, we're all going to be drooling into our cornflakes in 10 years because we won't be able to say or write anything. I mean, people have been complaining about how people use language as long as people have been using language, probably. I wasn't around for those early years, but that seems like it must be true. So there's not really a worse take. There is a weird one that is really difficult for people to give up, and that is the ending sentences with a preposition. So I've
up
had
with this, I shall not put.
Yeah, I've had teachers, educators, professional writers really, you know, say they can't stand it. Even college educated people are ending with prepositions. It's a disaster. But then sometimes, even while they're talking to me, they end with a preposition. And it's an example of how there's a giant gap between, for many people, their perception of what they do and what they actually do. And I'm interested in how language is actually used and in making people more aware that they may not always be quite as right about A, what they were taught 4 years ago, B, what they say today okay, I've run out of, I don't have a C. But anyway, I think that's it's part of self-awareness about all kinds of knowledge. Do you really know yourself?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Irregardless of that. Just kidding. we have, I don't think we're going to have time to get into this because we've only got a couple minutes left, but Karen in Champaign wrote in to ask about N dashes and M dashes. I'm just going to recommend there's a whole chapter on that in Rebel with the Claws. You can read it there. Ellen, I understand you've taken to asking people questions if they don't have a question for you. So I'd like to end by asking you to ask me a grammar question for our last minute or so of our conversation.
Well, I feel that I already know how you're going to answer this, but I still think it's interesting for listeners because people ask me about this a lot. When you form the possessive of a name, make this harder. When you form the possessive of a name ending in S, so let's say it's Charles's microphone.
My son's
what
name.
Do you do?
Yes.
What do you do with the end of Charles?
If I'm writing it for to be read, I just do S apostrophe typically. If I'm writing to read it aloud, I will do apostrophe S. S apostrophe S, I guess.
Oh, really? That's so interesting. But you would say them but the same, wouldn't you?
I would.
Yeah,
I would.
Right. And that's something I think that's interesting that Charles apostrophe and Charles apostrophe S really are mostly pronounced the same, but we have very strongly opinionated people about which is better. And they're both in use. So there you go.
All right. Well, if you have enjoyed this conversation, I think you will enjoy Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Its author is Ellen Jovan. Ellen, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks so much for being with us today on the
show. I did too. Thank you, Brian.
Well, every person you can know and every place that you can go and you can show, you know, they're nouns. A noun's a special kind of word. It's any name you ever heard.
And that's all the time we have for our show today. Thank you to everyone who called and wrote in. We love hearing from you. Keep the letters coming. Talk at 21st Show is our address. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.
To another state. Well, every person you can know, like a bandit or an engineer, and every place that you can go, like a state or a home, and anything that you can show, like animals and plants or a train, you know their nouns, you know their nouns. Oh, Mrs. Jones is a lady on Hudson Street. She sent her dog to bark at my brother and me. We gave her dog a big fat bone and now he barks at Mrs. Jones. She's a lady who lives on Hudson Street. Well, every person you can know, Mrs. Jones, a lady or a